I was asked to sit in on a jam session with the band, which was the predecessor of Kiss. I was an organizer in the 60s and the 70s, in addition to my music, and it's always been about changing the world.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
He could have been a lead guitarist in the band that preceded Kiss, but instead he leads the health innovation efforts of AARP and has dedicated his career to educating the entrepreneurial and investment world about the value of the longevity economy.
This is Tectonics. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan, and today's episode is brought to you by AARP Market Innovation, which works to spark innovation in the market that will benefit quality of life for people over 50. So people over 50, I know lots of those people. I guess they need some innovation, huh?
I'm going to be really interested in about a year.
Well, Jody Holtzman had grand plans to be a rock guitarist, but when push came to shove, he traded the big hair for big ideas. He has worked on economic development programs for developing nations, international environmental policy, and now ways of ensuring that people live their best lives as they age. As Senior Vice President of Market Innovation at AARP, Jody and his team have built an incredible movement among the entrepreneurial community designed for the longevity economy, a.k.a. older adults.
And not so older adults.
Yeah, they look older and older in retrospect only, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know. Yeah, we have to make sure that we ask him about his business of starting at 50. That seems really early.
I know for me that the pivotal moment when I realized that I qualified to care about this topic was when I had denied for years that the AARP card that my husband kept trying to foist on me, because he's considerably older, and I kept putting back in the drawer, and then I took it out one day and said, damn, there's some good discounts on here. So I knew I crossed the divide.
Oh my God, you crossed the Rubicon.
So Jody, it's so good to have you here today.
Nice to be with you.
I'm going to start by saying to you, the term that you have coined and that so many people are now using is the longevity economy. Can you start by telling us what that is anyway and why it's so promising?
Sure. So the concept came about in response to what is the dominant conversation in Washington when it comes to the demographic wave. And when you rip away all of the niceties, the common wisdom on both sides of the aisle is that we can't afford all these old people. Well, that's an economic claim. And you would push back at somebody and say, well, where's your evidence for that? And they would say, well, look at Medicare, look at Social Security, they're unsustainable.
This is the famous pig going through the python, right?
Right, the demographic wave, right. But what that was bait and switch. They were making an economic claim, but their evidence was not economic data. Their evidence was how two programs, federal programs, are designed. Well, I could design those programs so they're totally sustainable. It may not be politically feasible, but you could design those programs so they're sustainable. So that prompted the question, well, if that's not, you know, evidence for this claim, what is the evidence? And so we conceived of a standalone market economy driven with all the attributes of any market economy. Pick them, you know, the U.S., China, the U.K., could be Barbados. It doesn't matter. All macro economies have certain common attributes. So if you were to envision a standalone macro economy solely driven by the consumer spending of people over 50, well, what would the GDP of that economy be? And we hired Oxford Economics to run the numbers. And the first time we did the study, the number was $7.1 trillion, making it the third largest economy in the world after the U.S. and China. And we just updated the study, and it's now $7.6 trillion, so $500 billion larger in 3 years, which is primarily driven by the economics, by the demographics, and who these people are.
Right. So here's a question for you. I want to get into sort of how you wound up doing this, but I want to ask you a different question first, which is, from what you just said, it sounds like the problem isn't the market need. And I'm not sure anyone would have said, I'm surprised that people would have said, oh, is there a market here? It feels like there's this disconnect rather between the actual innovators. And, you know, it's so weird because, you know, one thinks that a market will take care of itself, that if there's a demand, then supply will come. Why has that proven so difficult? There's just, you know, whether you have this sophisticated calculation or even the back of the envelope, I think it's clear there's an incredible need to take care, to innovate for, you know, for an aging populace. Why is it so hard to come up with, to motivate folks to innovate for them?
You're exactly right as to the framing of the problem, and you have this interesting paradox, because on the one hand, you know, 110 million people, which is the number of people in the United States over 50, they spend over $5 trillion a year in consumer spending, including healthcare. And so you have to say, well, if they're spending all that money on things, you can't say there aren't things for them to buy. Well, there are things for them to buy, but they're simply making do with what's available. What you don't have are, to your point, the manufacturers, the companies, the design, the innovation that is more conscious of the unique qualities of this demographic and the segments across the demographic. I mean, you're talking about 110 million people. That's more people than most countries, so it's not a one-size-fits-all. But when you look at just basic things like, you know, go on to any of the travel sites, right? Just by going to the landing page of an Expedia, Travelocity, any of them, you would not know from that over 50% of leisure travel is bought and paid for by people over 50, let alone that 80% of luxury leisure travel is bought and paid for by people over 50. Why isn't it apparent? Because there aren't offerings that reflect the reality of travel for those people, whether it's intergenerational travel and families, you know, trying to plan, you know, big events, to just identifying the kinds of things and places where older people want to go, whether it's a bucket list kind of destination, I always wanted to go there, and now I finally have the time and the money to do so, you know, or other examples.
But I think part of the problem is inherent in the entrepreneurial community. I mean, most people think of entrepreneurs as, and most entrepreneurs are, those who are 22-year-old type, you know, ingenues, and not, you know, 58-year-old ingenues. And it seems to me that's very hard for the young entrepreneurs to solve problems they can't relate to at all. I mean, even at your own events, I hear these folks talk about solving a problem for their grandmother, but not really approaching the issues of the market beyond. So, do you think the very young can solve the problems of the very old?
I think they can if they're not approaching it assuming that they can, if they're not like premising it on all the myths about the very old and without an understanding of the unique qualities of older people. So, you know, one of the challenges for all entrepreneurs is getting real-time market feedback, right? And so you have the development of, you know, methodologies like Lean Startup, and you got Steve Blank and Eric Ries out there, you know, always talking about like constant, you know, iterative back and forth with the customer, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's all good on paper, and there are some companies that actually do it, but very few of them have the time or the money or even know how to go about, you know, creating that feedback loop. And so without that, you really are putting things into the market that make no sense. You know, the joke is how many consumer electronics products are out there that have a black background with black buttons and a 2-point font in black type that says what the button is.
I don't know, because I can't see them.
Exactly. And that's just the point, is that nobody can see it. And this is where concepts like design for all or universal design are especially important. So there are lots of examples of companies that actually by accident came into the realization that the older market had great potential, but they came to it by accident. So, for example, the Wii, you know, was designed to get younger, for the company to go younger and grab young gamers and then try to keep them loyal to the brand as they got older into more serious, you know, and more violent games. And what they didn't realize, what Nintendo didn't realize, was that they had designed the Wii for a small hand, and that the physical capabilities of that small hand actually were the mirror image of the physical capabilities of an older hand. And so, lo and behold, not only were younger gamers buying the thing, but they were going off the shelves and finding their way into assisted living facilities, nursing homes, long-term care facilities. Why? Because all of a sudden, the program managers in those institutions now had something that was fun, and they could get people off the couch and involved in physical activity. But Nintendo found that market almost, you know, by accident. And, you know, what if they were to do it on purpose?
So, Jody, you found your way to this market, this AARP older market, by accident, too, as I understand it. I mean, you really did start out as a musician and then moved on into a much different world. How did you get from there to here?
So, I come out of strategy consulting. And I mean, if you were to draw a thread through all the work that I've done, it's strategy. And and just previously to AARP, it was kind of traditional strategy. But I also have an expertise in not just competitive strategy, but in competitive intelligence. And I'm a fellow of the Society of Competitive Intelligence Professionals.
So that's like a thing, right?
Oh, it's a thing. Yeah, it is a thing. And, you know, and some people get into that coming out of strategy like I did. Other people come to it coming out of government, you know, kind of national security and national intelligence types of careers.
Well, maybe just take a step back. How did you find your way to strategy from rock music?
Well, let me finish the first one, and then I'll get into that. So I was strategizing back then, just not very effectively since I was not very successful. But so one of the things that I would do to build my book of business was to do all-day seminars, you know, kind of on the bookends of conferences. And the conference was great because they would bring together, you know, senior people with budget, and then I would get them to pay extra to one of my, you know, workshops. And back in late spring of 2005, I had about 40 people in the class, and a woman comes up to me midday and says, "Hi, I'm from AARP. We're going to be starting a group like this, and you know, if you know of anybody that could build it, you know, please pass their name along." So I start, you know, kind of debriefing with this woman about how they're doing it. And in my head, I'm kind of checking boxes, and it sounds like they're doing it, you know, in a best practice way. And I was kind of getting tired of consulting at that point. And I wanted to work for another big brand. I had been with PwC. I was part of the team that, you know, put the merger together. So AARP was a brand I knew, and that was about it. I mean, I knew my parents were members, and I knew they kind of did good stuff, but not with any real specificity. And so I was on staff 2 months later, and with a consulting gig in the middle. But I was brought in initially to create the first competitive intelligence group at AARP.
And so I know you moved from there into the innovation program, and I'm wondering, you know, what were you facing in so doing? I mean, when you started that group, which I think now is about 4 or 5 years ago, as I recall, you know, nobody out here in Silicon Valley had really ever thought to give any attention to that older population on the healthcare front, except to the extent, you know, you're building devices for cardiac surgery. Of course, you know, you're dealing with the older population, but from a, you know, more modern economic software standpoint, you know, what was that like?
Well, it was really great. You know, the first thing was I knew I was in the right place when people would say, "What the hell are you doing here?" And in all seriousness, you know, why we were there was not obvious to anybody, even to people who were eligible for AARP membership and were old enough for that. The market just does not, or back then at least, was not an obvious growth opportunity. And so very early on, you know, I and my team, you know, realized that it didn't take long to communicate and lay out the opportunity and the scale and scope of it. But it did need prodding. The other side of it was that we realized that for this to happen, for there to be an explosion of better, more relevant products and services to meet the needs of this cohort, well, there really had to be, you know, activity across the ecosystem. So it had to be the entrepreneurs, it had to be the VCs, it had to be industry, it had to be academia. And we started to see the opportunity to get each of those pieces of the ecosystem engaged. But one of the challenges is that particularly when it comes to, you know, the venture firms, you know, these are partnerships. And so to ask a partnership, that corporate forum, to start to do something new, that's money out of partners' pockets. And so to ask them to start a new focus of investment around a thematic like the longevity economy is really asking a lot. Lisa, you know this better than most. You have to hire people who can drive deal flow. You have to understand the market. You have to know the demand side, the supply side, all these different things. That's an investment. So what we did was we approached it by just posing one question. We said, when a startup comes looking for money and they come into your office with their hand out, add one single question to your list of diligence questions. And the question is, what's your 50-plus strategy? And how an entrepreneur answers that question will tell you tons about that individual, about their team, and how they're looking at the market.
So what are the top two or three problems that are really crying out for solution here, are the ones you're really focused on solving through your exploits out in the entrepreneurial community?
So, you know, you made reference earlier to you know, health innovation. You know, we came upon health really as the low-hanging fruit. Because on the one hand, we realized that, you know, perhaps individuals in the ecosystem, they may not know the details about, you know, unmet needs and solutions, but what they did understand were the demographics of health cost. That was something that was, you know, front and center. So then taking the conversation to how you address that was an easier step. There was a base of knowledge there on which to build, which is really just pragmatically how we first, you know, focused on healthcare. And but then as we started exploring it, not just from an opportunity standpoint, but really just to your point, you know, where are the unmet needs? It really has to do with the fact that people want to live at home, people want to continue to be active and participate in their communities with their families, they want to contribute, but they want to do it in a way that is on their terms, right? One of the biggest forms of ageism in the country, and I think globally, is that older people are infantilized, and we start to treat them, you know, like children. And, you know, and older people legitimately push back at that. You know, my mother, you know, she'll give you two middle fingers in the pushback. But good working class Jewish girl that she is from the Bronx. But, you know, part of that issue is caregiving. Part of the need is the caregivers. There are 40 million unpaid caregivers in the United States. By the way, 25% of them are millennials. They contribute over $450 billion in unpaid but economic value to the economy. There's a whole dynamic there, being able to age in place, a term that we've started to reject, we prefer connected living, which is much more positive. And also, more importantly, it recognizes the fact that really what this is about life.
So Jody, let me ask you sort of what might be viewed as a two-part question. The first is, you know, as I'm sure you probably saw, there's a beautiful piece in the New York Times that Katie Hafner recently wrote about, it was focused on England, but it was about the challenges of loneliness and the impact that has on people. But then the flip side I wanted to ask, and we'll link to that in our blog, but we also wanted to ask the flip side to that is, do you think people might underestimate the extent to which people who are older actually use technology, actually use the internet? I think about my aunt, who is incredibly proficient on Facebook, who gets unbelievable value from the internet, from the connectivity that it provides. And I think would just put to shame so many sort of dismissive expectations that I imagine some people have about folks who are older.
Yeah, I mean, that was a fabulous article. And, the big takeaway from that article...
She's a wonderful writer.
Yeah, and the big takeaway is that people have not viewed loneliness through the lens of health. And, you know, there's just enough literature at this point to just show that, you know, all of the attendant health problems that are derived from a situation in which, you know, somebody's lonely. Loneliness and isolation are overlapping, but not necessarily the same. There are people that, you know, they isolate themselves for various reasons, and, you know, they'll tell you, I don't like people and I want to be by myself. That's a circle that's hard to close.
But enough about Lisa. hardly. So let me ask you.
Well, actually, before you go on, David, I mean, I know you guys at AARP are collaborating with NASA in some ways on this problem, thinking about it because you have, you know, an not obvious but interestingly shared perspective on loneliness and isolation. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Sure. So I got an invitation from Susanna Fox, the Chief Technology Officer for HHS, to participate in a session down in Galveston, Texas, a place where normally I wouldn't have gone, that was being organized by both HHS and NASA, and NIH was involved, and all these different agencies, FEMA and a bunch of others, and IDEO was helping to organize it. And IDEO's methodology is to look at issues in the context of extreme environments and then try to cull out how individuals or groups of individuals kind of develop workarounds to address a particular challenge. And they kind of use that as the insight to tease out potential products and services. So anyway, they were looking at the issue of health in extreme environments. And, you know, people were talking about the isolation of astronauts up in space, clearly an extreme environment. And, you know, I said this to Lisa the other day, you know, being the old strategy consultant, you know, I never saw a 2x2 that I didn't like. And I immediately started, you know, thinking about, you know, what were the two axes that reflected that isolation. And so one axis is that it's the physicality issue, certainly physically isolated. It's the individual in the middle of space. You know, the only thing to, you know, talk to her is the asteroid going by. And but on the other hand, the other axis was the level of connectedness. The astronauts are totally connected. I mean, there are hundreds of people that are monitoring them, responding to every question, helping them get on, you know, Skype or some version video conferencing with their families, talking to school, you know, classrooms that have challenges and experiments that they want the astronaut to do, monitoring their physical environment inside the space station or inside a spaceship, you know, the rocket, whatever it is. I'm an old Trekkie, so it's a spaceship. You know, all of these things. But then I realized that, you know, for an older person who's isolated, it's the mirror opposite. On the one hand, you know, an older person could be in an apartment in an urban setting surrounded by thousands of people in other apartments, in the street, etc., but connected to no one. And so what's happened is we're now in the process of just exploring the possibility to conduct a challenge for entrepreneurs around this issue of isolation. And so we're not quite there yet in crafting the specific challenge language, but it really, you know, kind of teased up for all of us the idea that this is a, first of all, just a really interesting, you know, problem to solve, but it also, you know, are there commonalities that could be extracted out of these two seemingly different types of isolation that give us greater insight to both?
That seems like a very creative way to think integratively about this problem. Let me ask you, let me go in a little bit of a different direction and ask you a question that kind of, something I was thinking about from, I guess maybe you might call it the Silicon Valley perspective. And so there's this, you know, sort of famous joke in economics, right? Where one, you know, there's one friend walks, two guys walking down the street. In economics, they probably would be guys. One of them says, "Oh, it does, you know, there's a $10 bill on the street," and the other economist said, "Can't be. If there was, someone would have already picked it up, right?"
Right.
And the question is,
I thought you were going to do the chemist and the physicist and the economist on a desert island,
no.
And they find a can of beans, and they, you know, and the economist says, you know, imagine a can opener.
Assume a can opener. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I've written about that in my blog. Exactly. So here's how I was thinking about that. You know, the idea is that, you know, VCs, right, and who invest in startups are supposed to be really, really intensely focused on things that are going to make money. And that's sort of their goal. So there was a lot of controversy out, you know, here recently about VCs and gender diversity. And one of the responses, there was this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. I just remember so vividly reading about it. And it basically made that that argument, the $10 bill argument, that said, there can't be a problem with gender diversity, because if it made economic sense to have things differently, the system would have already figured it out. Right? I mean, that was basically what the article, I'm paraphrasing, but that was saying. So people are so motivated to make money, more than they are prejudiced, more than they are anything, that if whatever could be done to make money, a VC would do. But what I think comes up in the gender diversity, where we've seen vivid examples of that, not in terms of sort of PC gender diversity, and the idea of important life problems that are not adequately addressed because people don't recognize them who are investing as problems. It seems to me this is yet another unbelievably compelling example where you have a profound unmet need, a profound market, and yet there really seems to be this almost unaccountable disconnect between the need and between a market that's available for products and people innovating into that market. Do you think that's sort of a fair parallel between sort of the gender issues and the age issues, or are they more different phenomena?
No, I think there are similarities. I think you know, philosophically, you know, I have problems with the premises of the, you know, if people could make money, it would be solved already, because it assumes, getting back to assumptions in economics, it assumes that markets are perfect and they're going to fill all the gaps, you know, on the demand side. And markets don't, and that's why, you know, markets need to be prodded to fill social needs through a market that the market on its own wouldn't necessarily have even identified as a need, because markets typically go for lower hanging fruit. But you know, I think what's fascinating here is that, you know, we have started to see in the last couple of years that, you know, with everybody trying to figure out where is the next big growth opportunity, I do believe that we're at a tipping point. And one of the first of all, let me just tip my hat to Lisa and her former venture colleagues, you know, in that they invested in a company that was ahead of its time in addressing the older market, a company called Extend Health, that was the first company to create an online market for health insurance that was targeted Medicare-related health insurance, and then exited. And that exit was probably to this day the largest exit of relevance to this space. I think Lisa was like $435 million, something like that.
Lisa's always ahead of her time.
Right. So So, you know, so that was something. But aside from that big, nice size exit, certainly not a unicorn, but you know, not chump change either. You know, we haven't seen a lot of exits. That said, in the last 18 months or so, we have started to see some of the self-proclaimed top tier of the venture community starting to invest in this space. The reasons, because everybody's looking for where the growth is, but we've also started to see entrepreneurs who are bringing solutions that enable not just the ability to address a particular need, like find a caregiver, but to provide solutions that can do it at scale. And so just in the last 18 months, three startups in the find a caregiver space have raised over $120 million, including from, you know, players like Andreessen Horowitz, who plumped down, you know, $15 million in an A round, and then demanded a board seat, like, you know, Mark Andreessen doesn't have enough to keep him busy. So I think that there's a tipping point, but I will say this, there better be some exits, because that's what's going to sustain the interest.
So I know your parents were a big influence in your life, and in their late 80s, they're still around, aging gracefully in their home in New York, where you grew up and live. So what have they taught you about what you do today? Is there something they say to you that rings in your ears when you're thinking about your work?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, as you know, I quote my mother in particular extensively, you know, when I'm on stage. And I have permission to do so. What the world doesn't know, and now the world will know. I even have permission to make up quotes as long as they're in character. I think probably the most important thing is that people of every age, regardless of age, have a sense of dignity. And entrepreneurs have to understand that. And society has to understand that. You know, so I always think, and I've always done this in all the market-related, you know, strategy work I've done, I believe in markets of one, and that if you can solve for an individual, there may be a nugget there that is generalizable. So one of them, you know, has to do with looking at certain products that are in the market that are primarily bought and paid for not by the older care recipient or the older person, whether or not they're receiving care, but by the adult child. And, you know, I remember just, and this goes to your point earlier, Lisa, about, you know, the assumptions of young entrepreneurs. Well, one of those assumptions historically has been, oh, well, just, you know, who's going to pay? Who's going to buy it, right? You need to have a market, you got to have a buyer. Who's the buyer? The buyer's the boomer, the baby boomer, adult child. The problem is that unless you involve the older person in the sale and the transaction, it goes nowhere. So if I come home to, you know, my mother and I say, Mom, you know, just think, Dad took a fall, you know, we can now put in 24-hour, you know, remote monitoring, you'll be safe, and most importantly, I will have peace of mind. My mother could give a hoot whether or not I have peace of mind. What she wants is to know, how does this help her? And the lack of an understanding of how you frame a value proposition with regard to older people is like glaring in this space. People are, you know, they make assumptions that the sale is to the boomer and that's the only value proposition they need. Well, you got to get across my mother's threshold and allow you to put whatever it is in her home. Well, the conversation with her has to be completely different than the conversation with me. With me, it might well be peace of mind. With her, it has to be, how is this going to enable her to do the things she wants and needs to do? How will it give her control in a life situation where she starts to see control slipping away? How is it going to give her greater freedom at a time when her freedom is constrained? All these kinds of positive things.
I can really see how the combination of sort of making some points that people are able to viscerally understand in other markets and bringing it to the helping to frame and not just increase the need, but to helping people frame what are some of the issues is doing an incredible service. Let me ask you sort of an unrelated but a final question, okay, as we're kind of closing in at the end of our half hour here. As a musician, I understand that there's a song that you particularly appreciate, and we have it queued up right here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's The River by Bruce Springsteen.
Dream Alive That Don't Come True is the one you told me is your fave. And I'm wondering, as a closing thought, what dream are you currently working to make come true?
Well, the line is really important to me because I knew so many guys in particular that faced, you know, circumstances like Bruce wrote about. But that whole notion of, you know, you have to have a vision, and it's being able to execute against it and achieve it. And for me, you know, I was an organizer in the 60s and the 70s, in addition to my music, and it's always been about changing the world. And for me, that dream is to still change the world, and right now to do it in a way that ensures a high quality of life for older people and society at large.
That's great, Jody. Thank you so much for participating today in the podcast. We're grateful to have you on, and also for the sponsorship from AARP.
Deeply grateful.
Great to talk to you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Today's guest, Jody Holtzman, was speaking to us today from the Big Apple, where he's AARP's Senior Vice President of Market Innovation.
Such an interesting show, and so it's such an interesting and relevant topic. It's unbelievable out here the extent to which, you know, people understandably approach innovation, and we've seen so many examples of this sort of based on their own experiences, what they're familiar with. But, you know, what's some, you know, 20-something programmer's view of the important pressing issues in San Francisco, it may not represent the broad spectrum of issues that really need to be addressed or available to be addressed. It seems like just this unbelievably large, important, unserved opportunity.
Well, it's interesting because they, luckily for me, invited me to host their first live pitch innovation event for healthcare about 5 years ago. And it was a pretty tough event because there wasn't a lot of great companies to choose from, and the audience was sort of interested. And now, 5 years later, the work they've done to raise awareness of this challenge among the entrepreneurial and venture community has been amazing. Because the last program, which I also emceed with Alex Drain, you may recall was on our show
Absolutely.
Some time ago.
She's awesome.
Was like standing room only, you know, the who's who of everywhere showing up to participate. And I think, you know, the message is getting out.
I mean, I think one of the challenges, again, that one has in Silicon Valley is, you know, even with the VCs, even though many are older, there's this incredible youth culture of everybody, even people who are older. I mean, there was a recent interesting article you probably saw of all the plastic surgery and all of the, it was a Wall Street Journal feature about all the ways people in Silicon Valley are specifically, are people in the workforce are trying to look younger to fit in with what's perceived as sort of the expectation for youth culture. Though I would add that at our company, I think the average age of the CEO and all the various executive team seems to be, I think we're all AARP or almost.
Well,
see how we do, I guess.
It happens to all of us, and as my grandmother used to say, it beats the alternative.
Absolutely.
So we're so looking forward to our next guest, Ewan Ashley, a cardiologist and geneticist at Stanford, who might just be the most interesting man in Silicon Valley.
And you can follow the most interesting woman in Silicon Valley, Lisa Soonan, at VentureValkyrie.com, as well as on the Timmerman Report.
And you can follow the illustrious and super swell David Shaywitz at Forbes.
We are grateful to AARP for sponsoring this episode of Tectonics. AARP's market innovation team works to spark innovation in the market that will benefit the quality of life for people over 50.
This episode of Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonics Studio B in lovely Mill Valley, California.
Ciao.